Welcome to the AquariMax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 55, recorded March 28, 2011.
All right, we'd like to welcome Brian, a longtime contributor and friend of AquariMax. He's actually given us a lot of good ideas that have helped AquariMax grow in addition to the comments and so on related to aquariums. So we'd like to welcome him. We have a couple of ideas about what we're going to talk about today, but first we have some general questions about you and the hobby.
Okay, great. Hi, Russ and Kelly. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome you officially. Thank you for joining us on the show.
You're welcome. I've sure enjoyed the past programs.
Well, thank you. That's good to hear. We always like to hear that. All right.
Okay, tell us just a little bit of your general background in the aquarium hobby. How did you get started?
Back in the early 80s, my dad met a guy at the Geothermal Aquaculture Research Foundation in Boise, Idaho. And at the time, he had several 500-gallon freshwater tanks displayed at the Department of Agriculture here. And my dad and I were both immediately hooked. And he taught us how to make our first undergravel filter and got us going. And that was it for me. I've had an aquarium almost ever since. Hmm.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's fun. That's a good, interesting way to get into it. Maybe a little bit different pathway than most people take.
Yeah, it worked. I wish I knew then what I know now, so that every 6 months to a year I wasn't washing out the entire gravel bed of the aquarium and ruining the bacterial filter that was already developed, but I didn't know about cycling.
Right, I remember doing the same thing at about the same time, so there you go. Well, tell us a little bit about some of the species that you've kept. You don't necessarily have to give a comprehensive list, but just give us an idea of some of the things you've done.
Nothing too exotic or weird. I guess the most interesting fish I've had was a little pea puffer, and I kept her on my lab bench in a little 5-gallon aquarium, and she refused to eat prepared foods, and I had to feed her live foods. So it was great fun in a laboratory setting, and everybody in the lab liked to come over and watch her. Other than that, I seem to find myself preferring South American fishes, even though I do have a few Asian mixed in. Never kept any African cichlid species.
Okay. What are some of your favorite South Americans?
Right now, my favorite is I didn't write down exactly when I got it, but I think an 11-year-old rummy nose tetra that I have.
Wow.
11 years.
That's my favorite fish.
Yeah, that's pretty respectable for a little fish like that. I guess a lot of them can reach that age, but most of them in most aquaria usually don't, I guess.
That's what I keep hearing. I hear one or two other tetras that get that old, but keeps living. I can tell it has cataracts, but it finds its food and seems to be doing well enough.
That's pretty impressive.
Is it in with any other rummy noses, or?
Yeah, I've got it. It had been in a 55, and we moved and I downgraded, so it's in a 30-gallon with a few cardinals and some other rummy noses, Guami and Procostomus, and general community fish.
Okay. Let's see. Now, kind of relating to one of the projects that we're going to talk about. Now, you have your educational background is in biology, right?
Correct.
And specifically, what kind of biology again?
My degree is just a bachelor's of science biology, but I took as many aquatic ecology courses as I could. And I went to school in Seattle, so I spent a lot of time in the Puget Sound.
Okay. So with definite aquatic leanings, even though the degree is a general biology degree.
Yeah, it's real tough when you get to spend time living on an island in the Puget Sound doing research or going to Belize for tropical ecology courses.
Wow.
Yeah, twist your arm a little harder, huh?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I can see how that would be fun. Wow.
Since then, my professional background is in salmon habitat restoration.
Oh, cool.
Oh, neat.
I've managed to work in my field.
Yeah, that's always...
That's good.
Not only is it fun, it's...
Increasingly rare
yeah,
these
can
days.
Be difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's dive in a little bit to your research paper that you were kind enough to send to us so that we could read through it. And you said that you kind of started thinking about it from the episode when we talked a little bit about cycling and ammonia and so on.
Right. Yeah, the last episode, I don't remember which number.
53?
About, and the aquarist who wrote in and said she was having questions about what was going on with her tank, and you brought up cycling, and it triggered a memory of a paper I wrote.
All right. Well, let's... could you give us a... excuse me.
Oh,
I'll have
another
to
one.
Remember
we'll
it's about 6 minutes.
There
you go. Okay. A brief description of how you set up the experiment.
At the time, I was just getting interested in saltwater aquaria and was reading about Refugium and started looking around to see if anybody was using Refugia for freshwater tanks. And I found almost no literature on it. So I decided to set up just a little experiment, and it was easy enough to tell when a tank had cycled. That was a good point, so we could figure out, is there a difference if you use plants in a tank? How quickly do they affect the nitrogen cycle? And I guess you can relate that in my refugia search to are the plants going to be very effective at picking up nutrients out of the tank. So we used, I believe it was 9 aquariums, it's been quite a few years now, 9 aquariums, the plants in 3 with sand, 3 had no plants but sand, and then 3 had no plants or sand. And I put, I don't remember how many, I think about 15 goldfish in each tank, and they were about 30 gallons total. And started pulling out water samples, fed every tank, and then started taking water samples out and froze them and saved them so I could analyze them all for very small amounts of nitrogen. And no surprise, we all knew that the plant and tanks would take up nitrogen more quickly than the others, but we were all surprised at how much more quickly.
Right. Yeah, that was something that was interesting that I noted. Several interesting results that you had. Now, one thing that I thought was pretty interesting is that most planted aquarium keepers will tell you, yes, I don't have to worry about cycling as long as I plant my tank heavily to start with. I can put a moderate bioload in there and all the plants metabolize all of the ammonia or some form of nitrogen and it's not an issue. But one thing that I thought was pretty surprising is that in terms of plant mass in these tanks that you had set up, because you had a little, it was about 4.5 or 5 gallons was the little filter box in essence that the plants were contained in. Is that correct?
I would say it was probably about 1.5 gallons in size.
Oh, it was even smaller. Okay.
Yeah, it was not very big at all.
Okay. So it was just about 1.5 gallons for this 30 gallons, and it was, even that being packed with plants, that's pretty surprising that it could handle that much ammonia from, 10 to 15 goldfish. So that was kind of neat to see.
I didn't give it any lead time. I didn't allow them to cycle at all. Water, fish, and plants all went in at the same time.
Okay. So, so it was right from the get-go, the plants were having to deal with it, or the bacteria, or whatever, as the case may be. I guess you had, like you said, one that was just an empty control, group negative control with nothing in the box, and then the sand in one box, in one group, and then the plants and sand in the other group, right?
Right. Right.
Okay. Now, I noticed that all the plants you chose, let's see if I find the list of plants here. Oh, you had things like Bacopa and Rotala and Cabomba and Myriophyllum and all stem plants, except for the Vallisneria.
Right.
But mostly stem plants. Did you have particular reason for choosing that, or were those what was available, or?
That's what was donated by the local aquarium shops.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good reason.
Yeah. But, and I guess we have the, a lot of aquarists agree that the stem plants tend to be pretty effective nutrient absorbers in terms of speed and just converting ammonia to plant biomass, I guess. So that makes sense too.
Right.
Okay. Now, there were a lot of interesting things. I'm going to go to the tables. You included a couple of tables at the end here. And I put some notes on the tables, on the graphs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Where are we? Okay. In figure two of your paper, you showed that in the examples with the plants, of course, the ammonia and ammonium started out pretty low, but then went to almost zero fairly quickly within a few days.
Right.
With the plants. But this was an interesting thing, that both the sand, just the sand, and then the empty filter box, they peaked, which is not too surprising, and then they crashed, or in terms of the quantity of ammonia went from a spike to basically zero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not too surprising considering the sand, if the bacteria are, you know, the cycle is happening, and the bacteria are starting to turn it into nitrite. But in the empty filter box, now, why do you think it happens so quickly and almost at the same rate in the empty filter box as it does with the sand?
The sand wasn't filtering the water at all. Essentially, I put floated a tub in the aquarium,
mm-hmm.
and the water passed over the surface. So there might have been a little more surface area due to the roughness of the sand on the bottom of the box. But really, it wouldn't affect much. Water wasn't flowing through it.
Okay, so it wasn't mimicking the effect of a fluidized bed filter or anything like that?
Right, there would still have to be a bacterial film growing on top of it.
Okay. And do you think in the empty filter box, you were just getting bacterial film on the inside surface area of the tank and so on that was able to handle the ammonia?
Yeah, they were slimy.
Okay. Well, I guess that makes sense then. Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah, they were really slimy.
Okay.
But I don't have pictures in the paper, and I haven't looked at them a long time, but the water got really cloudy. I didn't have any mechanical filtration. It was all plants or bacteria. And in the paper I mentioned that I started, when I couldn't see any more fish, I drained it out.
Right.
And that was because they were so cloudy with particulate in the water, and I assume a lot of that was bacteria growing in the water column.
Oh, okay. Probably some heterotrophic bacteria, as mostly in the water then. Yeah, okay. And then the other figure three here, it's the concentrations of nitrite and nitrate. Once again, it's predictable that the planted aquarium would have a low level of both of those substances, but then the other two tanks, the quantity sharply decreased at a certain point. And other than, you know, water changes or some kind of denitrifying system in there, what do you think could have caused such a sharp decrease?
I think it was just bacterial film growing in the tanks and every surface area.
Okay.
And also in the water column. It was in a greenhouse. There was a lot of light.
Okay. Was there any algae in the water?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
But the water came out of the tap, so potentially, yes.
Okay. So it's possible that could be reducing that, too. That was interesting.
I kind of remember looking at the water through a microscope once, just out of curiosity, and, you know, seeing some single-celled algae.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing big anyway.
Okay, so probably not enough so that that was accounting for most of the removal of the nitrite and nitrate, but maybe some denitrifying bacteria and some lower oxygen part of the bacterial film or something?
Maybe. Sounds good.
Yeah, who knows?
It's all about surface area, right?
Yeah.
There we go.
We always joke about that. Surface area is one of my favorite things to say. let's see. Oh, yeah. This was kind of fun. You had in your suggestions for future research, you mentioned other research where they had used both bivalves and daphnia. And for those not acquainted with the term bivalve, it refers to clam or clam-like species of mollusks. To help in this whole system where you have plants, but you also have bivalves that are filtering particulates and daphnia that are filtering even finer particulates and algae, you mentioned that would be a good area for future research. Did you ever get around to doing that? Did you have a chance to? Or?
No, this is my senior research project, and soon after I went back to work.
Oh, okay.
So, no, I was never able to. I haven't ruled out a really low-flow refugium.
Uh-huh.
It wouldn't even need to have plants in it. It could just have daphnia and mussels or clams or some other bivalve. I want the light on a timer to keep the daphnia happy.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be really interesting. I guess you'd have to have some... If it was a low enough flow, the daphnia wouldn't all be washed out. You'd probably get some of them washing out, but not enough of them, the way they reproduce, to
right.
cause a dent in the population.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, I've got a group of daphnia, and I can take quite a number of them out every day, and the next day they're back to the same population. So I guess low enough flow, and you'd be there.
Yeah, I think it would be fun to do. It'd sure be interesting to watch.
Yeah, and I've heard people talk about using clams for filtration in an aquarium. I've never tried it, but that sounds interesting. I know in one of our marine aquariums in Hawaii, just from the live rock that we had several bivalves that were thriving in there that we didn't put in there on purpose. They just appeared. But, yeah, it's they're interesting creatures. So.
Yeah, I've caught a number of mussels and oysters and a giant clam in my saltwater tank, and I don't remember the exact figure or how much water that giant clam filters, but it's a huge amount of water.
I can bet. I guess that's their sole way to gather food is, and of course, oxygen and so on, just by all that filtration that they do.
Right.
And those clams get pretty large. How big is yours?
I haven't had it out in a little while to exactly measure. I think it's about 6 inches from tip of shell to tip of shell.
Okay, so.
Got it as a little guy and had it for about 4 years, I think.
Wow. Yeah, those, they have some beautiful colors. We ought to do a show on marine bivalves sometime in the reef aquarium. That would be fun.
Yeah, they're very interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think. Is there any other comments you had about the research project that you'd like to bring up?
Oh, not really, except to say that I'll get a good.
Except to
say, at least ammonia test kit, so you can make sure it gets cycled.
Yeah. That's a very useful thing to have around, of course, and I think the plants. Another plug for plants.
Yeah, and if nothing else, they bring a good source of bacteria into the tanks to seed a new aquarium.
Yeah, that's true, because you've got all that surface area. So even if you just put a small number of plants in there that aren't going to be enough to take care of all the ammonia, you're still seeding the tank. That's true. Good point. It's a good point. Okay, it looks like we need to take a break for just a second. And then we'll be back and ask you about your pond project.
Sounds good.
This isn't a commercial. because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Okay, we're back, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for staying with us. Brian is going to tell us a little bit about his pond. Now, this is a pond project, so it's not yet done, am I right?
Yeah, I don't have a pond yet. I have a space for a pond.
Okay. And it sounded like you had some interesting ideas of how you were going to put it together and so on. So what is your plan for this pond?
Well, since I'm a biologist and ecologist and like to work with native plants, that's my goal in putting this all together is to use as many native plants as possible. And that's to be a part of the landscaping. And it's going to spend a fair amount of time in direct sun, so I'm not even sure what type of fish, if any, I'll have in it. I know the water temperatures could get quite warm. Essentially, I'm trying to recreate a small mountain scene. I live in the Rocky Mountains, and I'm trying to bring a little bit of the mountains down to the valley. It's not going to be big, maybe 25 gallons,
mm-hmm.
and you'll have a small trickle into it and kind of tuck it into some pine trees and shrubs and, go from there. The biggest challenge for me is that I'm very water conscious and my hobbies tend to use a lot of water, and I'm trying to minimize that. I use a reverse osmosis deionizing filter since I have a marine aquarium.
Right.
I first got it for my freshwater aquarium because I got pea green water. It was full of algae, and I discovered I had high nitrates in my water source in my tap. So I started bringing home water from the lab every day, and my coworkers laughed at me. But the thing about these filters is, yes, they take it the water down to almost just H2O. There's not much more in it.
Right.
But to get that, you pass the water through a reverse osmosis membrane, and to get 1 gallon of clean water out takes 5 gallons.
Okay, so 4 gallons of effluent coming out, basically?
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Most people just tap that into their sewer line in their house or their sink or whatever and just let it wash down drain. But I'm trying to figure out a better way to use it. And right now it's watering the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to try and put it under a drip system and water the plants in this little scene. And have one line that feeds into the pond itself.
Okay, so the water source for the pond would be the effluent from your RO filter.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with it. It just has higher concentrations of whatever's in the water. It didn't pass through the membrane.
Right, so it would have quite a few nitrates, which the plants would appreciate.
That's a good question. I've moved since I originally got the filter, so I don't know what the nitrates are like here.
Ah, okay. But it will have, like, calcium and magnesium and who knows, that sort of thing in it.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So, now, will that be an issue for any of the plants that you're planning on using?
I doubt it. We live in a pretty hard soil area, and I just go collect plants out of the stream near my house or local pond or something.
Okay.
If I get fish, I'll get something that can tolerate hard water, like the molly or the platy.
Right. Okay, so if you put something in there like that, it would be a summer resident.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you anticipate any colonization by local amphibians or anything like that?
I have a frog that sings to me almost every night.
Oh. So you probably will. You know what species it happens to be, or?
I've only seen it once, and I didn't catch it long enough to figure it out, just to show my kids.
Okay. Well, that's kind of neat. We don't get much of that. Well, I guess it's too much of a desert around where we are, so we don't see frogs and swimming mammals.
I was quite surprised. It sounds like a little chorus frog, but I haven't figured it out yet.
Hmm. Yeah, my sister lived up somewhere around the same sort of area, and they had a frog that was calling, and they called me to ask me where it could possibly be, because it sounded like it was in their house. And then I said, well, it would be somewhere damp. If it's in your house, it couldn't survive very long if it weren't. And it was there for weeks. And they eventually found it. I think it was under their water heater or something like that, where water was dripping.
Oh.
And so they finally located it, but it had nearly driven them crazy with all the singing.
Yes, thank you, frog, at least for finding a water leak.
Yeah, at least it helped them out. They could address that, but yeah, I guess they, by that time, they were so crazed. They were just glad to discover the frog.
Well, we get our water source, water belongs to the irrigation system that we should have, the canal, and the frog is not underground. It's a little box around that they have cleaned. And like, the drip and the moisture in there, so I've seen it down there before.
Oh, okay. So it is a nice place to stay.
Yeah.
But he may well visit the pond once it's set up.
I'm guessing so.
Well, it sounds like it'd be a really nice pond. It's small, but manageable because it's small.
Mm-hmm.
And looks like it'd be a really nice piece of scenery, kind of blending in with the plants around, but looking like it's a little piece of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you'd like to, we'd like to get a picture once you're done and put it up. We can post it on the podcast resources page for this show. And probably also on the Aquarimax Facebook page. Check it out if you feel like it.
Sure. I wish I'd taken a picture of the Emperor
Jupiter
that we
put in the game. So you can get it before and after. Hmm. Well, let's see. I think that is about all of our questions, unless you have something else you'd like to say about the pond.
Not that I can really think of. It's a work in progress. We're still getting freezing temperatures here at night, so holding off on all the planting, and I'll be bringing in topsoil, and I've been out hiking and collecting large rocks, and it's a work in progress, but something fun to do.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to ask, what are you going to line it with?
It's an oval, animal trough.
Oh, okay. Like a horse trough or something like that?
Made tub.
Excuse me. I backed away from the phone as far as I could there, but I'm sorry. That was quite a loud one anyway. Well, it sounds like one thing that we can all take from this is that you need to be conscious about your water. I'm glad to hear that you're thinking about that as you're putting this pond together, and I think something we can all kind of take to heart, that water use for aquarists, sometimes we just think, oh yes, well, it's all going, all my water changes are going down the toilet and so on. And sometimes they have to, because you don't want things from water changes to get into local waterways, of course. But things like effluent from your RO filter, I mean, how many people think to use that? So that's a great idea.
I guess on the note of, water changes, I used to dump them down the drain, but I don't anymore. I now water the house plants. And I use kind of a filter for fertilizing them, and well, they go too fast now. And
I water the trees and water them on with the water change. I mean, I have to use a bucket. That's something I'm willing to do.
Yeah, and in the summer months, I like to run a hose out into the bed of plants, too, for my water changes and with that. You know, just every little bit counts.
And knowing that majority of our fish aren't yet aquaculture, they're not saying raised fish. They're studying all of the fish directly from where they're coming from and all of the water that's involved in that, the trolling and the shipping.
Right, because that ends up to be a fairly big footprint.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, thank you once again, Brian, for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, thanks for the show. I sure enjoyed it. We'll have to share your ideas.
Thank you. And we appreciate all the ideas and suggestions and comments that you've given. It really helps us keep going. And it's helping us grow, so we appreciate that a lot too. And we hope you'll be back on the show again sometime.
Sounds good, and I'll send you some pictures as soon as I can.
All right, great. Well, until next time, best fishes, as they say. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.